Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Max Boot, who is a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations and a columnist for the LA Times. His new book is War Made New: Technology, Warfare, and the Course of History, 1500 to Today. Max, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thanks for having me back.
What was your goal in writing this book?
Well, my goal was to help people understand the period of revolutionary change we're going through right now in military affairs, the information revolution, which has had a really profound effect on warfare over the course of the last 15 years. And there's been an awful lot written about it, but very little that sets it in historical perspective. And so what I tried to do is to provide some perspective on the changes we're seeing today by looking not only at the information revolution, but at three other revolutions in military affairs over the course of the past 500 years, going back to the gunpowder age, the first industrial revolution, the second industrial revolution, and now the information age, and looking at how all of those transformations changed not only the face of battle, but also what happens in the international balance of power.
Okay. And how long did it take you to write the book?
4 years.
Mm-hmm. And talk about the circumstances under which you conceived the idea and saw its importance.
Well, I conceived it in the summer of 2002 after my last book, The Savage Wars of Peace, came out, and I was looking around for a new book to write, and I had even more impetus to write it because at that point I was being hired by the Council on Foreign Relations from my previous job at the Wall Street Journal. And so this, I had to come up with a major project to work on while I was a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And this is what I came up with. And it was essentially the same process that I used to come up with my previous book, which was an attempt to shed some historical light on an ongoing controversy in military affairs. Savage Wars of Peace was about small wars, these low-intensity conflicts that we were engaged in places like Somalia, Bosnia, Kosovo, Haiti, and so forth. And so I tried to look at those kinds of conflicts going back over 200 years of American history. Now, with War Made New, the controversy that I'm trying to shed light on is this debate over military transformation and how should we transform the military to adapt to the changes of information age warfare. And to shed light on that, I go back 500 years and look at the whole world and everything that's happened to try to put into perspective what we're seeing today.
And the format you're using is to discuss each of these revolutions and actually look at a critical battle where one party successfully implemented what was then a revolution in a particular technology. Give us an example of that. Let's go back to the first stage. As you said a moment ago, you divide the book into four segments, and the first is the gunpowder revolution. Let's talk a little about that.
Sure. Well, the gunpowder really began to transform the battlefield around 1500 or so, and an advantage went to states that were able to mobilize effective gunpowder armies and navies. Some did, some didn't. The very first battle that I started writing about is the French invasion of Italy in 1494, where the French were pioneers in artillery. They had field artillery that they were able to wheel into Italy and to destroy these old-fashioned artillery, these old-fashioned fortresses that had protected Italian city-states for centuries. All of a sudden, their walls were getting knocked down, and the French were rampaging through Italy, and the Italians didn't know what hit them because the French had jumped out ahead with this key technology.
And is it that there was a as you look through this history, is it the case that the weaker adversary didn't know about the technology, or is it rather that they hadn't figured out how to configure it and implement it in their plan?
It's more that they couldn't configure it properly. In fact, the pattern that I see throughout this history is that very often the very same technology is available to both sides, but only one side figures out how to make use of it. And that really goes to having the right organizational structures, the right management culture, the right leadership training, all these human factors that are necessary in order to take advantage of technology. And, you know, one case of that, again, from the gunpowder age, is the Spanish Armada in 1588. I mean, Spain in 1588 was much bigger, much richer than England. And yet, why was the Spanish Armada defeated by the Royal Navy? It wasn't because The Spanish didn't have access to galleons and cannons and all the other technologies that the English had. It was because they didn't make very good use of it. Spain had an underdeveloped bureaucracy. You had King Philip II, who basically tried to run the whole state himself. He was a micromanager, whereas Queen Elizabeth had the makings of this nascent government bureaucracy that had the origins of the Admiralty and these other boards that came together to provide very effective warships and also the right crews and the right leadership, leaders like Drake and Hawkins and others who were tremendously adept at sail and shot tactics in a way that the Spanish simply were not.
Mm-hmm. And what is, you mentioned leadership and personality and so on, and so let's look at another age, say the first Industrial Revolution. And is it the personality the individual skills of the grunt coming together with the military commander, coming together with the political leaders? I mean, in looking at this whole sweep of history and especially that period, is it one of these that's more important or it's all of them together?
I tend to think that the most important levels of leadership are at the higher ends of the military and political chain because, you know, you obviously need brave soldiers to fight battles, but all countries produce brave soldiers. There's nothing unusual about that. The question is, are you going to have soldiers who are well-led and well-armed and well-trained for the kind of warfare that they face? Because if you don't, simply being brave isn't enough. And a classic example of that is one of the battles I look at from the First Industrial Revolution, which is the Battle of Omdurman in 1898, where the British were facing this jihadist uprising in the Sudan. And these jihadists, these Mahdists in the Sudan, were tremendously brave, just as jihadists are today, often brave to the point of being suicidal. But it wasn't enough to triumph over the British, who had a modern army, who had machine guns, who had repeating rifles, and used them tremendously effectively. And the Mahdists didn't have a tactical scheme to make effective use of all of their bravery. And so in early September of 1898, thousands of these Sudanese dervishes charged across open ground in front of their capital in Omdurman, right into these entrenched British positions. And they were mowed down by the thousands because they were just, all they had was rusty rifles and spears and swords against these British with their repeating rifles and machine guns. It was no contest. And it wasn't because the British were braver. It wasn't because the British had better warriors per se. It was because they had a better organizational structure to harness the technology of the day and to make use of it in a way that the Sudanese were unable to do.
And the bottom line here is you're saying that, for example, when you talk about the West's conflict with the Islamic world and, say, for example, the Ottoman Empire, that in the end, this adaption of technology successfully leading to battles really change the course ultimately of history and decide who's up and who's down.
These revolutions in military affairs have been tremendously consequential in determining who wins and who loses in this struggle for global primacy. I mean, all you have to do is look at the period before the Gunpowder Revolution around 1400 or 1450 and look who were the great powers of the world at that time. It wasn't the Europeans, it was the Chinese and the Mongols. The Europeans in 1450 controlled only 14% of the world's land surface. Yet by 1914, the Europeans controlled 84% of the world, largely because of their mastery of gunpowder technology and industrial technology, which allowed them to go everywhere around the world and to essentially defeat everybody that they met. This was the big story of the last 500 years, the rise of the West, and was made largely possible by the greater success that Westerners had in harnessing military technology in the period between 1500 and 1900.
And throughout these revolutions, what is the relationship of innovation and that particular event to the currents within the broader society? I mean, do the technological innovations, such as gunpowder, don't arise necessarily just out of military needs, right? Is it an adaptation of what's going on in the broader society?
No, in fact, if you look at the histories, the most important military inventions of the last 500 years were not military inventions, were in fact inventions that sort of came out of left field and did not come out of any Ministry of Defense or any armed force. I mean, starting with gunpowder, which came out of China and migrated its way westward, and nobody knows who invented it or why. Or if you look at three-masted sailing ships, or steam engines, railroads, steamships, telegraphs, radios, internal combustion engines, automobiles, airplanes, microchips, all of these key technologies of the last 500 years were not military in nature. I mean, the Wright brothers were not thinking, we've got to come up with a new way to kill millions of people. They were thinking, it'll be cool to fly. But out of that basic impulse, it would be cool to fly, came the dominant weapon system of the 20th century. And that's very often been the case, that inventions kind of come out of left field, and the trick for militaries is not so much making the inventions themselves, but figuring out how to harness these inventions, which are available to everybody, and figuring out how to harness them better than their adversaries do.
Mm-hmm. And I guess also you're suggesting that the evolution of bureaucracy and of the state are a very important element here. You mentioned Elizabeth before, and part of what we're witnessing is the rise of the English state and then the empire.
There's been a very close relationship between the nature of the state system over the course of the last 500 years and the nature of warfare. And the demands of the battlefield have driven the growth of the state consistently from about 1500 to the mid-20th century. With the rise of gunpowder armies, it was no longer enough to be a feudal lord. You needed much greater resources in order to harness gunpowder technology and put thousands of men with muskets and cannons into the field, and navies with armed with artillery. Those kinds of resources required a super lord. And so this became a powerful impetus for the growth of centralized states in Europe, nation states usually led by absolute monarchies. And those states, those areas which were not able to grow nation states, tended to be overrun by their neighbors. Italy being a classic example, where you had the Italian city-states, they didn't have unity, so they weren't able to generate as much power as they needed to protect themselves from gunpowder armies. And so they were overrun for hundreds of years, and Italy didn't become a unified nation-state until the mid-19th century, whereas others, Britain, France, Russia, and others, were more successful in centralizing authority and harnessing the gunpowder revolution. So there's been a very close relationship here, and up through the industrial era, where the demands of industrial warfare provided a powerful impetus for further growth of government and the development of these giant welfare and warfare states that could mobilize millions of men, send millions of men to their deaths, but also had the capacity to pay pensions to those who survived. Mm-hmm. Now, while the trend for the last 400 or so, 50 years or more, has been towards centralization, however, in the information age, I would argue the trend is going the other way, towards decentralization. Mm-hmm. And so this is a reversal from many of the things we've seen previously in warfare.
Mm-hmm. We recently had on our program the Nobel laureate from Harvard, Vogel, who's done a lot of work on the illness through the life cycle. And the source of the data is the data that was collected by the Civil War veterans, so exactly what you're saying, right. The spinoff, domestically.
I mean, in fact, the kind of the very idea of bureaucracy or organization, which we all take for granted, was really a military invention. I mean, the first modern bureaucracies were military. And in fact, some of the very terms that we associate with business life come from the military. For example, company. The original companies mm-hmm. were collections of mercenaries in Italy in the 15th century. That's where the term comes from. Or freelance. Those were individual soldiers, mercenaries, who were for hire by states. And the fact that they all came together led to the rise of these bureaucratic structures, not only in government, but in business. This is really the origin of the way modern life is organized.
Mm-hmm. Could it be, because one of the themes that we're hearing in current affairs is the whole notion of the privatization, you know, of the military. I'm curious, throughout this history, is there any conclusion we can draw about who more successfully can implement innovations, whether it's private militaries and private entities or really the state, that can essentially embrace technology for warfare?
Well, really, since 1700 or so, the primary driver of change in the military sphere has been the state, and you've seen the decline of mercenaries and private companies, which were incredibly important up through the mid-18th century. Mm-hmm. Now, along with the declining power of the state, you're seeing the increasing mm-hmm. power of private companies. And, you know, I would argue mercenaries are probably more important in the world today than any time, probably going back to 1700 or so, that the U.S. military, for example, relies on private companies to a very large extent. It couldn't operate in places like Iraq or Afghanistan if it didn't have the logistical infrastructure provided by KBR, a Halliburton subsidiary, doing many of the jobs that the military would have done itself 50 years ago. But now the state is getting out of those businesses and turning it over to the private sector. And so, you know, in Iraq, for example, you have something like 20,000 private contractors with guns running around. I mean, there's many more private contractors, but just the armed ones are about 20,000, which actually makes them the second largest troop contingent in Iraq after the U.S. military. So this is part of kind of back to the future, back to the early modern period in terms of the importance of the privateer on the battlefield.
If we look at World War One, is this a conflict that led not to decisive victory but stalemate? And does that happen often in history?
It does happen often in history. That, I mean, what World War One was sort of came about because of essentially a historical accident, which was that the technology of the day had jumped ahead. But the thinking of the generals on both sides had not really kept up with the technology, and in particular, the power of defensive technology, because this happened at a period when the defensive happened to have the advantage in warfare. And so you had machine guns, quick-firing artillery, barbed wire, all these technologies, which made it very hard to charge across open ground against an entrenched adversary. But it took 4 years of slaughter for both sides to finally realize the futility of what they were doing. And it was only around 1917 or 1918 that you saw the development of technologies to break the stalemate. For example, the British inventing the tank. But those weren't used decisively in World War I. I mean, there were plans, the British had plans to use tanks decisively in 1919, but thankfully the war was over by then. So this became the technology of the next war and of the next revolution. And it wasn't the British who had the most success in harnessing their own technology.
If we look at World War II, why did the Germans and the Japanese lose, because at a certain point in their reach for empire, they were doing very well?
Well, the conventional explanation of why the Axis powers lost World War II is simply that they couldn't compete in the battle of production lines with the Soviet Union and the United States, that these two countries were so big, so powerful, they could churn out so much machinery and so many people that they simply crushed the Axis with the weight of numbers. And there is some truth to that, but it's not a complete or entirely accurate explanation. Because, in fact, if you look at what the world looked like around 1942, the Axis were pretty powerful. They controlled all of Europe and East Asia. And Germany, in effect, was in charge of what is today the European Union, which has resources comparable to that of the United States. One of the difficulties they had, however, was they couldn't harness all of the resources at their disposal. In many ways, Germany and Japan had incredibly ineffective bureaucracies, hobbled in Germany's case by the fact that it was a one-man show, and beneath Hitler there was all this competition and chaos, and there wasn't an effective mobilization of resources, which is a little bit paradoxical because this was a dictatorship, but it wasn't a very efficient dictatorship. And, you know, they weren't able to harness their industrial machinery in the same way that the Soviets or the Americans did, much more effectively. Ultimately, it was the fact that the U.S. and the Soviet Union had more resources, but it was also the fact that they were able to harness them better, and also that they got better at what they turned out and how they used it. I mean, the Soviets in particular, by 1943, 1944, became very adept at tank warfare, and the U.S. became very adept at aircraft carrier warfare and at long-range bomber warfare. All these key technologies where they had been behind when the war started, but very quickly caught up. And if they hadn't caught up, even the fact that they had this giant economic advantage might not have sufficed to deliver them victory.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, this capacity on both the part of the U.S. and the Soviet Union was a reflection of what was going on, you know, in society. So that the Soviets, after major defeats at the hands of the Germans, were, under a planned economy, able to mobilize the infrastructure to sort of build anew to produce all of these tanks, whereas the U.S., coming from a very different place from the developments of Henry Ford in the private sector, was able to mobilize in the strategic aircraft area.
Right. I mean, both the U.S. and the Soviet Union, with their various different systems, nevertheless had effective means of tapping into industrial technology and just churning out tons of tanks, airplanes, all the modern machinery of warfare. And they weren't as different as they might seem, you know, on paper, because although the U.S. had a private sector economy and the Soviets didn't, there was a fair degree of state planning and state control even in our private sector economy. But it was essentially, you know, a partnership between big business and big government, which was tremendously effective in, and it was really the U.S. that churned out more machinery than pretty much everybody else combined, that, and we churned out a lot of the stuff that the Soviets used as well, and tremendously successful in doing that. But also, we mustn't lose sight of the fact that we did have generals and admirals who became increasingly effective in utilizing that machinery. Because, and this is a point I want to stress, which is that material advantage does not necessarily determine the outcome. It's really how you use it. And if you're incompetent enough, you can squander any material advantage. You have to have a certain degree of skill in how you utilize it. And, you know, by 1944, 1945, we had, you know, admirals like Halsey and generals like Patton and others who were pretty adept at utilizing what our factories were churning out.
And on the Soviet side, Marshal Zhukov could overcome all of the shortcomings of Stalin.
Right. And gradually, Stalin learned to give up some authority, operational control to his generals and trust them more and let the professionals do the work of military operations instead of micromanaging and meddling in all these things. And Stalin figured out how to be more of a hands-off manager than Hitler, who kept foisting horrible decisions off on his military just because of the whims of the moment.
World War II ends, and really the use of technology, which leads to victory, essentially defines the world order for the next 50 years, basically, in terms of the bipolar world that that we came to know. And I guess the question becomes, if we look, once we recognize that, is it the case that there is a tendency throughout this history to fight the last war where you won and then not be prepared for the next conflict?
Well, there is a tendency to fight the last war, but there is also a tendency to fight the next war, which never arrives. And these are equal dangers that you have to guard yourself against. And we always hear about generals being too conservative and being too prepared to fight the last war and not being ready for the challenges of the day. And of course, there are numerous examples of that very phenomenon. But there are also examples of the countervailing phenomenon. For example, the fact that, you know, after 1945, it was assumed by everybody that the atomic bomb would become the key weapon in any future warfare. And the U.S. Army remade itself for warfare in the atomic age. It came up with something called the pentatomic structure, and it ordered all sorts of new weapons designed to fire atomic rounds, including, you know, atomic mortars and artillery pieces and tactical aircraft, all of the stuff that in retrospect seems like something out of Dr. Strangelove. And yet this was really how people thought the next war would be fought in the 1950s. And of course it wasn't, thankfully. But there was a price to be paid for this desire to be on the cutting edge, which was that the U.S. military was not so ready for the actual war that it had to fight in Vietnam, which was not a war against an enemy with atomic weapons, but a very low-tech enemy, nevertheless very adept at guerrilla warfare, which was not a kind of warfare that the U.S. military prepared itself for. So you have to guard against both impulses, the impulse to be too reactionary, but also the impulse to be too cutting edge if the future you perceive is not the one that actually arrives.
Mm-hmm. As I recall from our first interview, you were born in the Soviet Union and then immigrated to the U.S. What does this discussion that we're having now tell us about why the Soviet Union unraveled and the U.S. became, you know, the only superpower in the world? Because there wasn't a military conflict. There was no battle, you know, that decisively led to that outcome.
Well, there wasn't a battle. There was certainly the war in Afghanistan, which bled the Red Army dry in a way that the U.S. Army had been bled dry in Vietnam. But I think information technology had an awful lot to do with the downfall of the Soviet Union. The fact that we have a Silicon Valley and they didn't, I think, helped to precipitate their downfall, because by the early 1980s, the Soviet leadership was looking around the world and realizing they were falling further and further behind the U.S. in both civilian and military technology. They couldn't compete because we were making all of these advances with microchips, and this became a real threat to them. And in a way, Afghanistan further demonstrated the threat because one of the most effective weapon systems employed in Afghanistan was the Stinger missile, which was a product of our information breakthroughs, which negated a lot of the power of Soviet aircraft. And so in a variety of ways, the Soviets realized they were losing the race against the United States, and they tried to reform themselves. This was the basic impetus for what Gorbachev did with perestroika and glasnost. Obviously, it failed. They tried to change the system, but they what they found was instead the system simply collapsed. So you can't say it's all due to information technology, but I think information technology played a large part in precipitating the collapse of the Soviet Union when it occurred.
And when the wall came down and we were left with the U.S. Standing alone as the greatest global power, and in a way really sort of positioned to dominate the world in all regions and so on. And, you know, in your book, or it was in one of your columns, I don't remember which, you really point to the extent to which that in terms of military budgets that no one comes near us. And in fact, we're spending, you write, $500 billion on the military, almost as much as the rest of the world combined. And but this is the key that I wanted to emphasize. We spend more on research and development, testing and evaluation of new weapons than any other defense budget in its entirety. So in 2006, we spent $71 billion. And in that same year, Russia's defense budget will be $65 billion total. China, $56 billion, France at $45 billion, and Japan and the UK at $42 billion. So that really gives us a place in the future with no challengers.
Well, it gives us a place in the future with no challengers at the high end, the conventional end of warfare, where we're utterly dominant. I mean, nobody else is building F-22 stealth fighters or Nimitz-class aircraft carriers or Virginia-class submarines or M1 main battle tanks. I mean, kind of the technology of conventional high-end warfare, we are undisputed masters and really have been since the collapse of the Soviet Union and our victory in the Gulf War, which showcased the prowess of a lot of these weapon systems. But of course, our enemies aren't standing still, and this is a pattern you see throughout every revolution in military affairs going back 500 years. Nobody's lead is unchallenged, and even first movers, early movers, can find their lead being dissipating over time as challengers figure out new ways to adapt. And sometimes it means copying the technology that you've innovated. Other times it means coming up with tactics that negate the impact of your technology. And we're seeing now our enemies are doing both. For example, a lot of the cutting-edge technologies of the early 1990s are absolutely commonplace around the world. When you think about GPS devices, for example, or satellite reconnaissance imagery, I mean, this was the most closely guarded secret in the U.S. government 10, 15 years ago, and it still is in some ways, the satellite images of the Earth. Well, now you can go to Maps, Google, and see the exact kind of images that were classified 10 or 15 years ago. Anybody can have access to this kind of technology. The same is true with night vision devices and other things that pioneered in the U.S. So those are getting out to everybody, including our enemies. But our enemies are also figuring out new ways to attack us that nullify the advantage of our firepower. They've learned from the mistakes of somebody like Saddam Hussein, who was stupid enough twice to put armies into the open field against the American military and watch them be wiped out with our precision weaponry. There aren't too many people who are going to be stupid enough to do that. So our enemies now are trying to get nuclear weapons to negate some of our conventional advantage, or they're resorting to terrorist tactics, which don't present an obvious target for retaliation by the United States. So we're seeing, even as we're spending all this money on our defense budget, we're seeing our military lead chipped away by various competitors.
At one point, you quote, whether in the book or a column, I'm sorry, I can't remember, General Schumacher, I think, who talks about the difficulties of a hierarchy fighting a network. Right. And because the history you're talking about has presumed that the implementation in the organization, I don't mean you're presuming that, but what you see in the data is increasingly complex hierarchical organizations, whereas once you get into the age of networks, it's a different ballgame. Talk a little about that.
Well, what we've seen in the last 20, 25 years is the democratization of information. It's no longer held by a handful of large organizations, whether companies or governments. I mean, nobody has to wait until 6:30 in the evening to get their evening news from a network newscast. You can get your news anytime, all the time. And this is, of course, a microcosm of the changes sweeping through society. And what we've seen is that new types of organizational structures are successful in the information age, different types from the kind that were successful in the industrial age. Mm-hmm. Companies like GM or Ford or U.S. Steel, which can't adapt organizationally to these changes, don't do very well. And you see the rise of new competitors, whether Ford or Walmart or eBay or Dell or Microsoft, that have different organizational structures for harnessing information technology. Mm-hmm. And exactly the same thing is happening in the realm of international security, where unfortunately, in many ways, the U.S. government is kind of the GM or Ford of governments. It's this old line industrial vertical bureaucracy that was very effective during the Cold War or World War II, but isn't so effective today. Whereas our enemies are kind of the eBay of terrorism, this lean, decentralized network without lots of decision-making delegated to numerous layers of command. It's pushed out to the people on the spot. You know, I was making this point a few weeks ago at Annapolis, and one of the officers there said, you know, sir, what's the advantage that Al-Qaeda has over the U.S. military? It's that they don't need travel orders to go outside their AOR, their area of responsibility. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a humorous way to put it, but it gets at a larger truth, which is that we have this giant bureaucracy and they don't. And bureaucracies are good for certain things, but they also slow you down, they hinder you, they make it hard to respond very quickly. And so for that basic reason, in many ways, I think our enemy is proving more nimble and more adaptable than we are. Mm-hmm.
And let's break this down, because there are two problems I see as we get into our discussion of the information age. One is the skill base, and as you get this democratization of information, you're also getting easier technologies to use, I would guess. So that's one level, the skill base, and how do we fare there versus our adversaries. And then the other is really ideological motivation, because we're now dealing with actors who seem to have soldiers who are motivated by a narrow definition of religious ideals, whereas we have become, you know, our society has become a California society, you know, laid back, wanting to live the good life as opposed to fight the good war.
I think there's a large element of truth in that, but I think the ideological motivation is less important, in part because it's less novel. We have often in the past faced adversaries who were more ideologically motivated than we were and more willing to court death than we were. And there's often been the perception in the past that as a rich commercial nation that we're weak and soft and decadent and can't compete with the Germans or the Japanese, these other militarists. And in fact, we have competed very well when we've mobilized the full resources of our society. What makes it difficult to compete today is it's hard to know what to do with all of our resources. I mean, we have this amazing capacity now to, with our smart bombs, to destroy any spot on the planet. We can kill anybody we want to kill, but we don't know who to kill.
Somebody looking at a picture in Washington, really, too, right? Or in a base in the United States, right?
What do you mean?
The image.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's our enemies have access to some of the same imagery, but I was just going to say that although we have this amazing destructive capacity and we can use our bombs to kill anybody you want to kill, we don't know who to kill. Because when we were fighting the Germans or Japanese, you had very obvious targets, and you don't have very obvious targets today, and that's deliberate, because our enemies realize that if they present obvious targets for us, they will lose. So they're fighting in a way that plays to their strengths and hits our weaknesses. And they have much greater capacity than ever before, essentially because they're utilizing our own technology. I mean, there have certainly been no shortage of guerrillas in the past, no shortage of religious fundamentalists. Well, what's different about these guys is they're able to wage their insurgency not just in one region or one country, but all over the world, because they're using jumbo jets and the internet and cell phones and satellite television, all these made-in-America technologies they're utilizing tremendously effectively to become sort of super guerrillas, super terrorists, the most potent insurgents in history. That's the challenge that we face today.
So then, as we talk about what the information offers and the kind of new organizational structures required, you're suggesting that other kinds of skills become very important once you get into conflict. For example, languages, understanding of a particular region or particular people, understanding the tactics that the other side is using to draw on their support for the people. Talk a little about that.
Well, essentially what we've been seeing in the last 2 years in places like Iraq and Afghanistan is the limitations of our technology. I mean, we have all these wonderful weapon systems, but F-22s or nuclear-powered aircraft carriers are not going to pacify Baghdad or Fallujah. For those kinds of tasks, smart bombs aren't all that effective. What you need is smart people and lots of people, lots of boots on the ground and the right kind of boots. You need people who understand the local culture and language, who understand how to wage counterinsurgency, how to engage in state building and policing and military intelligence and all these other functions which have been in short supply in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. In other words, you need the right kind of organizational structure to produce the right kind of people to wage this war, because machines aren't going to be enough. Machines are helpful, but they're not going to be enough. And we need to have the right kind of people to take on these tasks.
And what you're suggesting means, and these are resources and training that actually come from places like universities, actually. So in a funny kind of way, where you might find the most resistance to war is also the place that is creating the kind of skills that are absolutely essential, unless the military does it itself.
Right, and the military does not do a great job of education itself. I think they really need to rely on civilian universities. And when you look just, for example, where the officer corps comes from, almost all of it comes from ROTC programs, not from the military academies. And a lot of the higher training comes from sending officers to get advanced degrees at civilian universities as well. So that becomes tremendously important. And I think what we need now is what we had in the early days of the Cold War, when you had kind of a crash program to teach Russian, to understand the communist system, Marxism, Leninism, to understand Chinese culture and the culture of other communist nations. We have to expand our understanding of our adversaries, which is still in many ways in the very early stages. And we haven't done nearly enough, I think, over the course of the last 5 years since 9/11. I mean, I was really struck. There was a story in the Washington Post a few weeks ago about how 5 years after 9/11, the FBI still, out of 12,000 special agents, has only 33 who speak Arabic. 33 out of 12,000. I mean, that's mind-boggling. Why haven't they done more on that front? And the military hasn't done any better either. Those are the kind of skills we need to develop, because there's no shortage of folks in our military who know how to fly jets or steer ships or command tanks. Those skills we're on top of. But these other skills of cultural understanding and knowledge of our enemies were woefully deficient. We have to do something to correct those deficiencies, because the high-end skills are not going to save us.
Let's look at recent wars, because there has been an effort in Afghanistan and in Iraq to essentially implement the information, revolution. So let's talk a little first about Afghanistan, where initially we seem to be more successful. Well, I guess that's also true of Iraq. But talk about those two conflicts and to what extent our success or failures reflected some of the insights that you're offering us.
Well, Afghanistan was kind of presented as a showcase of warfare in the information age. In many ways it was, at least in the early part of the war, in the fall of 2001. But I think it's important to be clear about what was unique and different about the way we fought in Afghanistan. What got a lot of attention, at least initially, was this weird juxtaposition of new and old technologies, because you had special forces operatives riding on horses and carrying satellite radios and laser designators to call in precision airstrikes, which was a tremendously effective combination, no question about it. So it was like this combination of the Flintstones and the Jetsons, which had everybody kind of scratching their heads in awe. But there was another element to the campaign which hasn't gotten as much attention, but which came through it when I talked to some of the Green Berets who participated in this initial campaign, where what they pointed out to me was the lack of bureaucracy and the fact that it was such a big advantage to them that the military didn't have any off-the-shelf plans for invading Afghanistan. They kind of had to make it up on the spot. And I remember talking to one of these captains who led a Special Forces A-team, and he said basically we were called into for a briefing after 9/11, and we were given five PowerPoint slides and basically said, okay, your job is to go out and coup the Taliban and get al-Qaeda, and how you do it is up to you, so go up. Then they were infiltrated in there, and they had to figure it out on the fly, and they didn't know what they were doing initially, but they were tremendously smart, tremendously educated, and in fact, these Green Berets are some of the most culturally aware people in the entire U.S. Armed Forces. They do get language training, they do get cultural training, so they knew how to operate with foreign cultures, and so they were tremendously effective because they had the freedom to be effective. Of course, the technology was an important part of it, and the fact that they could call in these smart bombs and help their Northern Alliance allies was important, but the key was this improvisational, freewheeling nature of war. I mean, there was one story that I thought really captured this, where one of these Green Berets who was fighting near Bagram Airfield outside of Kabul, they were calling in airstrikes on the Taliban positions, which were very close by, but they were having trouble figuring out, you know, were these airstrikes being effective or not. So what this Green Beret did was he had one of his Northern Alliance allies get on the radio and pretend to be a Taliban and say, you know, hey, Ahmed, I see that the Americans were dropping their bombs. Are you okay? Were you hit? And Ahmed comes back and says, no, we're fine. Don't worry about it. They hit the car next to our house, which is burning, but we're fine. And so then the Green Beret says, okay, gotcha, and calls in the air power and says, okay, see that burning car down there? Hit the house right next to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of an example of this freewheeling improvisation that occurred. But unfortunately, it didn't last very long. It didn't last much beyond the fall of the Taliban in November and December of 2001. And before long, the regular army arrived, you know, with its PXs and its paperwork. And everything kind of slowed down. You couldn't maintain this very frenetic pace of operations that the Green Berets were carrying out. And pretty soon you had the regular army with their procedures, layers of command. And we started losing ground against the Taliban. And by now, I would say the Taliban are more effective, more freewheeling, more improvisational than we are. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the challenge we face, is how do we break through our bureaucracy and adapt to change as well as our enemy?
Mm-hmm. And of course, the Bush administration put its sights on Iraq, which also comes to play here. But let's talk a little about Iraq. In other words, the military victory, the first phase, so to speak, went well, but then things unravel. So talk a little about the lessons of your book with regard to what has gone wrong in Iraq.
Well, Iraq in some ways was a testing ground for these theories of military transformation that were in vogue around 4 or 5 years ago, the theories that Don Rumsfeld and company came into office with. And the basic idea that Rumsfeld had was that you could do more with less. You know, in the way that banks get rid of human tellers and put ATM machines in, so too the military could get rid of soldiers and do more with technology. And that's not a completely crazy idea. And it is the case that you can do more with less in a conventional engagement. We didn't need a lot of troops to go to Baghdad. It takes very few American soldiers to defeat the Republican Guard and Saddam Hussein's army. With all this amazing precision firepower we have on call, we can do it very easily and very cheaply. The problem occurs once you get to Baghdad. Okay, you can take Baghdad with 120,000 troops. That's not a problem. The problem is you can't hold a country of 25 million people with 120,000 troops. You got to have boots on the ground. And we didn't have boots on the ground, and we compounded that problem by dissolving the Iraqi army. So if we weren't going to send a lot of troops, we had to depend upon the Iraqis. But then we couldn't depend upon them because we dissolved them. And so utter chaos broke down, and we weren't ready to handle the situation because we didn't have enough boots, and also because we hadn't done the planning for post-war Iraq. And I think part of the reason why we hadn't done the planning, I mean, obviously there was tremendous stupidity on the part of the administration, but it goes deeper than that, I think, because we didn't really have the structures to plan for something like post-war Iraq. We have excellent structures for planning military campaigns, but not for what comes next. Mm-hmm. And when they were starting to think about what do you do after the fall of Baghdad, they created this new agency called the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance. They created it 2 months before the invasion began. Now, I don't care who's running an office like that. It could be Superman. You're not going to be effective 2 months ahead of time. I mean, this takes years to plan to run a country the size of Iraq, and we don't have the organizational structure to do that planning, so everything... It was a haphazard, last-minute type of thing, and whereas that kind of last-minute freewheeling atmosphere paid off in Afghanistan, this was a much more formidable undertaking to get the structure to run a country, which we didn't have, And we've paid a huge price for that in the years since.
When, as I was preparing for this interview, I went back and looked at my first interview with you about the Savage. We were talking there about the Savage Wars that America had fought. And it struck me that in your critique of the Vietnam War, which you actually just talked about, the fallacy there was to be fighting and preparing for the last war, namely World War II. And that it almost has a sense, as I listen to you and think about what has happened, that the fallacy here was that we weren't ready to fight the future war, which we thought we could win in that way and right. and achieve victory. So it's sort of been reversed, but equal failures in
right.
some sense.
Well, I mean, in some ways, you could say that the failure in Iraq grew out of the success in Afghanistan, because everybody was kind of entranced in the fall of 2001 to see the fact that you could put a few hundred special forces operatives into this country and they could achieve success very rapidly. And so I think there was kind of the sense that you could have similar success in Iraq. And in some ways you did, as I say. I mean, in terms of taking down the Saddam Hussein regime, we were able to do that very quickly and much more easily than a lot of people expected. But then you get into the more difficult nation-building stage, and in both Afghanistan and in Iraq, that's proven to be a real challenge. That's proven to be our Achilles heel. That's where we're weak and vulnerable, whereas we seem omnipotent when it comes to conventional military operations.
The other war that one should speak briefly about is the recent war in Lebanon between Israel and the Hezbollah, because it would seem that that war offers some of the same lessons that you're deriving from your book, a set of plans that were irrelevant for the way the adversary was prepared to fight, adapting cell phones, new kinds of plans, new technologies with a very limited force that was very ideologically motivated.
Yeah, no, I was struck by a lot of those lessons in Israel this summer, which I visited during the war, and saw that they were really grappling with very many of the same issues that the U.S. military is grappling with. I mean, the way that the Israelis tried to fight in Lebanon very much reminded me of the way we've tried to fight in places like Bosnia and Kosovo, which is to rely on air power to minimize our own casualties and to inflict damage on the enemy. But Hezbollah was clever enough to neutralize a lot of that through the simple expedient of locating their rockets in civilian neighborhoods, which makes it very hard for the Israelis to bomb. And when they do bomb, it always causes collateral damage. And Hezbollah was very effective at playing the information war, at putting dead babies on TV and saying, look, this is what Israel has done. And Israel didn't have a good counter to that. This was a huge part of any campaign that we face today, this media war that has to be waged, has to be won. But Western powers are often not the most effective at it. And it, I mean, in fact, if you look at the disparity between Israel and Hezbollah, I mean, Hezbollah is not even a state, and yet they have their own satellite TV network, Al-Manar. Israel doesn't have a satellite TV network. I mean, this is a huge disparity where these Hezbollah guys are much more effective at the spin game than the Israelis are. And they're also better armed than traditional guerrillas or terrorists are. They're kind of a terrorist army because they don't have a formal army structure, but they're very well trained. They have effective anti-tank weapons, anti-ship weapons, many of them created by the Chinese or Russians using essentially information technology, which negates some of the advantage that Israel has with its traditional weapon systems like the tanks. So Hezbollah was very effective in integrating all these different kinds of ways at war to negate some of the advantages that the Israelis, with their much more formidable conventional military, have.
I have a big picture question here for you, because I know you are identified as a neoconservative, and I think it's fair to say that you're a Wilsonian, really. You because of where you were born and what you saw as you made this transition to America, you have a sense of the power of American ideals and so on. And I guess the question becomes, since you are aware of those issues, but on the other hand, you're grounded in history in terms of the technology and so on. What we're kind of seeing is a disjunction between American ideals and how they might transform the world, and then the implementation, the effective use of military technology, which makes the difference when you come to war. And I'm wondering, after this recent experience, do you have further thoughts about how one integrates those two to make effective policy for the U.S. as a global power? Obviously, in the case of Iraq, this equation has not worked.
Well, when you say that I'm a, you know, Wilsonian or neocon, I could just as easily say that I'm a Rooseveltian or a Reaganite, but somebody who believes, as have so many of the great leaders of the United States, that the United States does well when we do good, that our power is not only the raw economic or military power we have, but the power of our ideals, the things that we stand for. And we ought to be championing those ideals in world affairs, not just to help others, but to help ourselves. But of course, as we try to implement our ideals, we have to be prudent in their implementation, and we have to be aware of the limitations of our power. And I think what we're seeing in Iraq is a lesson, just as we saw in Vietnam, and some of the limitations of our power, that we don't have the kind of organization necessary to run a country of 26 million people. It may be that we don't have the will to run a country of 26 million people. So obviously we have to be prudent about engaging in those kinds of nation-building exercises if we don't have the resources or the will to carry it out. But at the same time, I don't think we can just pursue the cynical realpolitik approach to foreign policy. I don't think that's ever been terribly successful. I think we can still promote our ideals, not necessarily in military ways. I mean, sometimes you use military power, but not most of the time. And I think the war on terrorism was a lot like the Cold War, where you have to use all the instruments of national power, not just the military. And this is one of the weaknesses that we see, which is that in many ways the military is the most competent branch of our government. They can put thousands, tens of thousands of people in the field with organization, with structure, with equipment. They can do things. But many of the people that we actually need to get the job done in places like Iraq or Afghanistan are not in uniform. They're people from the CIA or State Department or the U.S. Agency for International Development or other, or the Treasury or the Agriculture Department or from non-governmental organizations, all these other resources that we have that we're not tapping into. And everything is kind of falling onto the military by default because we're not utilizing the other resources of our government and of our society. And that, I think, is essentially, part of it is an issue of will, but also an issue of organization. We don't have a very effective instrument for making all the different branches of our government work together. The State Department, for example, is not used to operating in war zones. There has to be a change of mentality and a change of structure so that we get better at these kinds of engagements. But we also have to realize that the most successful interventions are not going to be military. They're going to be pre-military. We have to get involved before we get to the issue of using military force. I mean, just think about how much good we could have done in Afghanistan in the 1990s when the country was sliding into chaos. If we'd gotten proactively involved and tried to stand up a representative government before the Taliban took over, we might have been able to avoid 9/11, and we certainly could have avoided the long-term military engagement that we're involved in now. So that's what I really argue is as a, you know, as a quote, Wilsonian or neocon or whatever you want to call me, but I think we have to be a global leader. We have to be engaged in the world. We have to take a leadership position. And yeah, we have to use the military sometimes, but we also have to get much more effective at using non-military instruments of power.
I guess the question now that I want to ask is this. Given your book, War Made New, and all the lessons you draw from that, if I asked you to apply that book to the Bush administration and the leadership of Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld, what grade would you give them? And then what evaluation would you write in the side note in the blue book?
Well, at this point, I'd have to give them a D minus or maybe an F plus. Mm-hmm. I don't think they have been tremendously effective. And this is, in many ways, the puzzle of the Bush administration, because I think that their ideals and the goals that they espouse are right on. I think those mm-hmm. are in the best tradition of American foreign policy, and I think it's what the country and the world need now. The issue has been implementation, and their implementation has been abysmal, which is in some ways a mystery because you look at, for example, Don Rumsfeld, successful CEO, Dick Cheney, successful CEO, George W. Bush, the first MBA president. I mean, going in, you would have thought that management and implementation would have been the strong suit of these guys, but it really hasn't been. And this goes back, you know, to the theme of my book, War Made New, which is the importance of organization for harnessing military power. And we have tremendous technology, we have tremendous people in the armed services and in other agencies of government, but they haven't really been utilized very well. They haven't had the right structures or the right leadership to take advantage of what we have. We've had this kind of ad hoc approach in places like Iraq, which hasn't been effective in dealing with the problems that we face. So I don't think it's an issue of of overarching vision, which I generally support, is an issue of how do you carry out that vision? And that's a real problem today.
And what do you think that the consequences of this these episodes, especially the one in Iraq, will be for the long-term relationship of the civilian leadership to the military, and also for the revitalization of the military, because we still have to do transformation. It's not going to go away just because this particular war was a fiasco.
Well, it's very possible that you may see long-term damage to civil-military relations of the kind that you saw after Vietnam, with a lot of people in the military possibly pointing fingers at the civilian leadership and saying we were stabbed in the back, and a lot of these same kinds of ideas that were prevalent after Vietnam. And I think that would be unfortunate if it were to happen, because there's no question that the military has not had great civilian leadership. But the military has lots of problems of its own, including bad military leadership. I mean, when you look at who's most responsible for a lot of the problems that we face in Iraq, it's not just people like Don Rumsfeld or Jerry Bremer. It's also people like General Tommy Franks and General Ricardo Sanchez. A lot of the people in uniform have made huge mistakes as well, which anybody in uniform will tell you. So you can't just put all the blame on the civilians. The military also has to look within. And right now, one of the positives that I see coming out of Iraq so far is that, you know, defeat concentrates the mind, and defeat is a powerful impetus for reform. It can break through institutional barriers to reform. And right now you're seeing a lot of very positive reforms happening within the military because of the demands of Iraq. For example, a new counterinsurgency manual is coming out. The kind of training troops get before going over there has changed completely from these kind of tank-on-tank engagements to training in stability operations and occupation. You're seeing changes in military curricula, more emphasis being placed on understanding foreign languages and cultures. There's a lot of positive things going on, and I think it's vitally important going forward, whatever happens in Iraq, that these changes persist. But there's a real danger that they won't. There's a danger you may have this kind of post-Vietnam backlash where the military turns its back on change, turns its back on the civilian leadership, and says, you know, we want to get out of this business. We don't want to do counterinsurgency. We want to go do something else, which would be deeply unfortunate, because the more we show that we're not able to do counterinsurgency, the more we will face precisely those kinds of wars, because that's what our enemies will try to exploit.
Max, so on that note, let me first show your book and recommend it to our audience to get a historical background about what revolution means in military affairs, and also a lot of insight on the revolution we're going through now. So thank you very much for being with us today, and you're always welcome back in Berkeley. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.